Hi, my name is Helen. I am 22 years old. Today is December 2nd, 2018. I am speaking with Bill Camillus, who is my father. We are recording this interview in Tejeros, New Mexico, just outside of Albuquerque. And today we are discussing his work history in Mexico during the 90s to about 2010 doing trading. And so, Dad, how did you start doing your trading in Mexico?
Well, I had always had an interest in working with a culture, another group, to get to know another culture. And that was always my dream. Insurance that I was working at the time in 1992, 93 was not my dream. What sealed the deal was one day I saw this guy in the middle of the day with a beard and long hair driving in a Jeep, obviously doing his own thing. And I thought, that's me. I need to be doing my own thing too. And an opportunity came up to join a group called St. Jude's Express. And they were operating out of the Peacecraft store at the time on Central Avenue in Albuquerque. And I asked if I could join them. And they said, yes. So I did. And made my first trip down to the Sierras.
And so how did you continue doing your work in the Sierras? What pushed you to really...
My work was exclusively with the Tarahumara in the Sierra Madre Occidental in the state of Chihuahua. And that was my focus, though I did eventually begin to trade with some crafters and builders in Juarez.
What were
the... For the most part, it was in the Sierras.
What were the relationships like? How did you build them and find them?
I started just visiting with other people just to get sort of a lay of the land and see how things were working. I had the good fortune of taking a couple of trips, just bringing in medical supplies and food and with the St. Jude's Express group, which was, I remember one time I had a Volkswagen van and I brought 600 pounds of pinto beans. Another trip, I bought boxes and boxes of clothes. But then I was able to meet somebody who was actually trading down there and made a trip with him. Mm. And sort of felt my way around and decided how I wanted to do it.
So you went from doing essentially almost charity work to navigating culturally amongst these people and then continuously traveling back up to the States and back down.
Yeah, it started out slow. It was really interesting. The trips were they impressed me greatly, unlike the work that I was doing at the time. I was working in an office as an insurance adjuster, handling liability claims with very nice people. But the way this business worked was they just piled it on and piled it on and piled it on. And when the opportunity came to do something independent, I took it. And I've always had an entrepreneurial spirit. I've always had other little businesses that I like to start. So, and this seemed reasonable.
So does this entrepreneurial spirit drive from like childhood or early adulthood, or does it just, was it kind of a blossoming thing during
the
insurance?
No, childhood probably. When I was a kid growing in upstate New York, I was raised in an Irish Catholic family. We lived in a location outside of New York City, and it was wooded, but previously it used to be farmland. And so I found basically dumps in the backyard. In the back of our wooded yard, there was a rock wall, and along this rock wall would be the periodic dump. And in the dumps, I could find antique bottles from 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. It was fascinating. And so I began a little business with that. I used to catalog them, identify them, catalog them, assess their value, and throw them in a backpack and go trade at the antique stores as a kid. Come home with $15, $20, and woo!
So you had an active working knowledge of Spanish prior to going to Mexico, right?
I had an academic working knowledge of Spanish, which really didn't fly in the real world. So once you're working with the actual people, even people in a particular region, it changes, and the jargon changes. So there was some adapting to do there. There was a lot of learning, but I got around to it. But I had enough to get started.
So outside of the charity work you were essentially doing, how did you move forward to the trading?
I ended up buying a 1967 International pickup truck for $1,100. Then I just started to save money. And I think I made my first trip while on vacation with the 67 International and my $400, and went down into Mexico and made my first foray, and had a village to start in, and then started just going from there further in to more remote villages and visiting with people.
So did visiting with people construct relationships in which furthered into a business relationship?
It did. And it became apparent that there were numerous artisans within the region that were excited to do trading. And what fascinated me was that you were doing business with people that actually appreciated the trading that you were doing. So if you're buying a pot or a wooden bowl that they call a batea, or whatever it was, a palm basket, they were very grateful for your trade. Whereas here in the States, your business is typically taken for granted.
So speaking of the States, how did this business essentially translate into a mini economy that centered you?
At the beginning, I was trading with artisans in various locations and getting their handmade crafts. After a while, I started a wood shop in a mountain village called Panalashik, at about 8,200 feet above sea level in the Sierra Madres. And we started building furniture, simple things to begin with, benches and coffee tables. And as we did that, we began to employ numerous tarahumaras. They used to make ox yokes, which they call yugos, for oxen. And we would take the ox yokes and use them as a feature on the furniture. We also used boards that the tarahumaras made by hand. And so we had numerous tarahumaras who were making these boards and selling them to us. We used wrought iron for draw pulls, for hinges on doors. We also used tarahumaras to make those. We used rawhide leather, and we had tarahumaras that prepared that. We had tarahumaras that assisted in building the crafts, the furniture. And in the end, we estimated at one point that we probably had 50 different people within the community assisting us with our little business.
So with your little business, did it begin to accrue profit quickly, or was it a project in love, so to speak?
I knew I was never going to get rich. I just knew it. I mean, other people were doing well. Their financial circumstances were different. Many of the other fellas that were involved in this at the time had wives, and they were making good money. And so in terms of their home expenses, they really didn't have to worry about that. They could just build their capital, come back, make sales, build their cash, and go back and do it again. I, on the other hand, was the breadwinner, so I had to make it work for the family, which it did. Ultimately, it did. I knew I wasn't going to get rich. Things were tight quite often, but I felt it was worth it.
So no regrets?
No regrets. None whatsoever.
So in terms of like the American-Mexican diaspora, in terms of like socioeconomic disparity, where did you really fit this whole thing inside of it?
I didn't really pay attention to, I didn't go to Mexico trying to act like an American. I didn't go to Mexico trying to show off. I didn't go to Mexico to make anybody feel bad. I went really just to blend in and be a part of whatever was going on. At the beginning, I thought, I'll be able to change something. I'll be able to improve something. they all make a difference, which was nonsense. The only thing that changed with my trading was me. And so everything I experienced changed me. I didn't change anything really, but they did change me.
Well, with those changes, do you think that it not only affected you, but how you went into raising your family and really how you interacted with the world, say, north of the Sierras?
Got to the point where I'd be down there for 3-4 days, a week, week and a half, and on my way back, I'd start getting knots in my stomach. It just, the lifestyle up here is just so different. In fact, I'd met many Mexican citizens who clarified without any reservation that they had no interest in coming to the United States. They all thought we were nuts up here. Life is just too crazy, too hectic.
What about American life makes you say that?
It was a fast pace. The materialism, the competition. Competition is ferocious on every level in terms of the clothes you wear, the way you comb your hair, your glasses, your shoes, your home, the whole nine yards. It's very competitive.
And then how would you view a Mexican lifestyle, or at least where you were located, in contrast?
Simple village life, which really, for the most part, here in the States, doesn't exist.
And so when we'll bring it back to, in terms of like economics, how did your trading system work? Since you employed about like 50 or so villagers in the Sierras, how did that translate to working up here, considering you brought the economy back up here?
What happened up here was that I had the opportunity to work with some Native American artists who were doing some work on the wooden bowls, and they got to help me do the actual hard work on the furniture. They would help me offload trailers, they would help me finish the furniture pieces, load the car, truck, trailer, and take it to market. So that was fun. So I was able to provide additional employment for some folks up here, and then the rest of it really was just on me in terms of keeping up all of my paperwork, taxes, setting up new clients, getting out there and meeting people. And that was the fun part. When you're self-employed, the term I use is you have to make things happen. So when you're sitting around and nothing's happening and your cash is dwindling, it's time to load up the truck and the trailer and head out and make something happen.
So in the most extreme cases, how did you make it happen?
Well, just typically it was loading up the truck and trailer and hitting the road and heading out to a certain market. Maybe that was Sedona, Arizona. Maybe that was up in Santa Fe. I did very little work in Santa Fe, actually. They were just very greedy up in Santa Fe. They were obscene, actually. Colorado, would head out to Texas, established a number of clients out there, and eventually ended up with a pretty decent client base. And the idea was that I would bring items back, have custom orders, prepare them, and then load them and deliver them and get paid.
So with these custom orders, were they pieces that the clientele had requested, or did they come from like a home-built catalog, essentially?
Eventually it would be, we started making just whatever we could make, and then we would sell whatever we had. And then we became a bit more sophisticated in terms of deciding what it was we wanted to build, establishing a catalog, and then showing it to our clients so that they could actually pick through and say, I'd like 2 of these, give me 3 of those, give me 5 of these. So we got a bit more sophisticated slowly as we went along. Albuquerque was like a frontier town at the time. I would do trading in Dallas. I had my mother living in Dallas at the time. And it was fascinating. I dropped my 67 International into Dallas, and it was just, wow. You know, the huge skyscrapers, and the retailers were fascinating. I would pull up with my things, and they loved it. And instead of picking a few things like they would here in Albuquerque, they would just take bunches. Store owner would come out, look at the things on the trailer. We'd pull a thing or two out so they'd get a sense of the quality. Then they were hooked. And then it was just, give me this, give me that, give me that. I'll take, how many of those do you have? I have five. I'll take all of those. It was fascinating. I mean, I just got merchandise moving quickly. It was great.
So throughout this early 90s to 2000 to about 2010, what was the farthest you ended up traveling into the States to get to move furniture?
Florida.
So from Albuquerque, or from the Sierras, all the way to Florida.
From the Sierras all the way to Albuquerque to get everything prepared. And then when you were a baby, we'd throw you in the truck and we would drive out to Florida to do a four-day Native American arts and crafts show. And the organizer of the show recognized that Taro Matas, as an American indigenous group, a probable trader of Native American groups here in the States throughout their history, and so decided to include us in what we were doing in the show.
So you became almost a participant in Native cultures across the board, not just in the Sierras, but in New Mexico, and then...
Absolutely. In other words, what I was doing seemed to attract other Native groups. As I had mentioned, we had an individual from Hopi out in Arizona, Second Mesa. We had a gentleman from Acoma and a few others, Native American fellows that helped and participated with some of the crafts that we made. A fellow named Chris Chino from Acoma used to do beautiful black ink designs on the dough bowls. Ernest Salina from Second Mesa, a Hopi artist, used to burn in a fabulous Kachina designs and then paint them, and they were just beautiful, breathtaking.
So how else has this endeavor really changed not only things for you, but the communities, do you think?
Well, in the Sierras, many fellows were able to build a house based off of what we were doing and improve the lives for them and their families. I continued not only when we were building furniture, but I continued to work with other artisans that were making pottery and the wooden bowls and kiva ladders and pine needle baskets and a variety of items, and they always appreciated whatever business I did with them. And typically, as I understood it from them, I paid probably 4 to 5 times more than the typical trader.
So in terms of trading and creating this mini economy, did these business relationships stem into personal relationships as well?
In Mexico?
Both.
Yeah. No. In Mexico, I had lots of friends throughout the village where I worked and throughout that region. People all the way through that I liked and visited with. Here in the States, we had folks from New Hampshire, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, California, a variety of states that would come over here to the house to look at merchandise and pick it up and take it back with them.
Do you still hear from them once in a while?
Once in a while, but they've all kind of gone their own way.
So what ended up happening that kind of put, essentially caused a slowdown in this business that you essentially created?
The economic crash in 08 actually started back in 06, I had a retail store in Central Avenue at the time. You might remember that as a little girl. And we were doing pretty brisk business. And then right at about March, April of 06, things started to drop by about 2/3. And so I started to call around to find out if other people were experiencing the same thing, and they were. It didn't matter where they were. I called folks in Florida. They were experiencing the same trend. Folks in Colorado, Texas, Arizona, same deal. That was a big part of what ended it. A lot of the retail stores disappeared. A lot of the folks that I worked with disappeared. Complementing that was violence in Mexico, drug war, for the most part, not only in the Sierras, but really in Juarez. It became dangerous to go. My guys called me at one point and said, don't come. There was a murder in Creel, which is a tourist town down in the Sierras. I used to visit it every time I went. Apparently a group of gangsters drove into the town. The police disappeared. This group lined themselves outside of a dance hall. And when this family came out, including kids and infants, they opened fire, killing 13 people. And then these gangsters went and hid in a village back in the Sierras. And it just happened to be the village that I had my wood shop in. So they called and said, don't come. After that, they a couple times we would send a family loaded with a trailer to the border, and then I would get somebody to cross the merchandise to El Paso. But I realized they were using a family with a wife and two kids, and I just thought, no, that's enough. So things just dried up. It got bad. 2009 was very, very skinny. There wasn't much going on at all. Went to markets. Retail was very slow, very quiet. 2010 just squeaked by. And I decided at the end of 2010 that would be it. So we'd wrap it up.
How did you approach this slowdown? And what was your experience in essentially pulling out of this business that you had essentially been a part of for a little over 10 years?
Well, I fought with it for another probably 3 years beyond what I should have, but I had established relationships. I recognized a lot of these people depended upon this income in Mexico to survive. No one here cared. You know, it's everybody gets on with their business and moves past it, and no big deal. But down in Mexico, there was nothing to replace what we were doing. And so I hung in there, 07, 08, 09, 2010, just struggling with it, eking out whatever I could for as long as I could until we all recognized that we were beating a dead horse. There was nowhere to go at this point, so we had to stop.
And so how did those relationships with the people in Mexico really continue after the slowdown of work and business?
What they did in the village was just resorted to some of their old ways. They're subsistence farmers, and so a lot of them started working their properties again, started growing crops. Many of them had acquired new skills while working with us, and they managed to eke out a little bit of business throughout the years and continue to do so, but nothing close to what we were doing, as you might say, back in the day.
Would you ever choose to pursue something like this again? Maybe not in the same capacity or in the same way, but create your own mini economy through yourself and through Mexico?
Oh, absolutely. It's hard work. You know, being self-employed, you have to self-direct. You have to get up each day and, like I say, make something happen and move forward. You have to have self-discipline. But yet, it's ultimately very rewarding as opposed to what I'm doing currently, where you work hard and no one's really paying attention. No one says thank you. It's a whole different existence.
So what would you think about or consider doing again?
Potentially returning to the Sierras, but perhaps in a different capacity. Perhaps trading, not necessarily in furniture, which is heavy and bulky and requires considerable equipment just to move it around. Lots of labor to prepare it and get it ready for market. But perhaps back in trading with some of the arts and crafts that the Tarahumaras work at, maybe some writing and photography.
So in terms of culture, how did this really, through this whole experience, even up till now, really change how, from before you really started going to Mexico to now, what would you say is like the biggest change or influence that you've really seen in not only yourself, but in the world around you?
Well, question everything. I always did, but after being in Mexico and seeing a group of people get along without 90% of what we've created here is a huge life lesson. We purchased a small house that we could afford. I lived within my means, which is typical of most in the small Mexican villages. They live on a cash economy. They don't have credit cards. They don't have the mall where they can go out and spend money that they don't have. So we didn't do that. We lived like you would in a Mexican village in terms of operating with cash, operating within our means, extending out credit on a very limited basis, and questioning everything.
Would you ever change or do anything differently?
What do you mean, like now?
Now, yeah.
No, it's frustrating to have experienced doing something like that and then having to stop. And it's basically like being in hot and cold water.
It's like being put back in a cage?
Well, in many respects. You go work for a corporation here or get a job, so to speak. You're not an entrepreneur anymore. You're not calling your own shots. You're not making your own decisions. You've got a group of people somewhere else calling you or sending emails ceaselessly, instructing you as to what's next. And then within that, I'm fortunate in that I get to work by myself, make 90% of the decisions. But still, you're working for somebody else, taking care of somebody else's business.
So would you say working in a community-based setting where the people and yourself are involved in are all very involved in the process versus a corporate, you know, triangle-esque structure system?
I felt that working with the villagers was suited me. I wasn't interested in working for a corporation, ever was. Your grandfather had some pretty rough experiences working for corporate America. It's very cutthroat, and most people lose. A few win, but most don't. And so being able to be free, which is a component of this freedom, we are Americans, and there's consistent talk about being free, but who is actually free? My concern is that not many are. One of the American poet laureates said, who was an African-American gentleman, that slavery never disappeared, it just transformed. Now it's voluntary slavery. And I just didn't want to participate in that.
So in opposition to, say, your upbringing in an Irish Catholic family in New York, this was very outside of your realm of normalcy growing up.
Yeah. In fact, nobody got it. You know, I have to admit, looking back at this point, that nobody understood what I was doing. Nobody had the remote and no interest in trying to figure it out either, which shocked me. I found it fascinating. I would call your grandmother from Sisogishik, which is one of the main Catholic centers in the Sierras. There's a lot of nuns and priests and brothers and schools, and I'd be at a little store calling her up, and she's on a high rise somewhere in Manhattan. we would compare our days. Well, she's in a high rise in Manhattan, cloudy skies, and I'm in the Sierras at 7,000 plus feet high, and it's a beautiful blue sky, and the tarahumaras are walking in the street.
So it was like trying to look through a mirror in a different world, essentially.
It is. I got to walk in two worlds. And that's what the language, speaking Spanish, has allowed. And then there's the physical walking of being in their territory, walking in their shoes, living in their communities, sleeping in their houses.
So would you prefer a lifestyle where at least everyone, say, in the U.S. got to experience at least life at a slower pace? Or maybe not necessarily in a slower pace, but at least get to experience a cultural change that allowed them to step outside their own shoes.
Exactly. I think some kind of cultural experience that's different enough from what they're accustomed to, which gives them the opportunity to look at the way they've been living and question it. not in a negative way, not to say that the way they've been living is bad necessarily, but just to be able to see it clear through different eyes is advantageous.
So, speaking of advantageous, in terms of, like, legal, like, crossing your merchandise legally and getting all of that stuff, what did you really experience with, like, our procedures and, like, border patrol and stuff like that?
Oh, at the beginning, it was an adventure. It was, on the Mexican side, it was fast and loose. The way it worked is you showed up with your truck and your trailer, and there was this old gentleman that everybody knew, and he would be at the fence. I mean, literally at the fence. There's this fence, he's standing there, and if it's closed, you stay in Mexico. If he opens it, then you get to cross into the United States, and he was the man. And what he did when you drove up is he would look at your merchandise, how much you had, whatever it was, the size of your trailer, and he would come up with a number that you had to pay as duty. And so you'd fill out some paperwork, pay whatever this fee was, and then you could cross. The scary part was, do I have enough cash? Do I know what that fee is going to be? Will I have enough to cover it? And so that was always interesting. But then they revised their system. They actually got a little office. They got people. They got paperwork. They got customs brokers on the Mexican side so that you submitted your receipts. You listed out what merchandise you had, and you itemized it, gave a dollar amount for it, and then they would assess a tax, which was pretty consistent, trip after trip. And then you'd show up in the office, submit your paperwork, they'd stamp it and do all their stuff, enter some things in a computer, and then you wait a little bit, and then they'd clear you to go.
Did you ever have any difficulty through this process? Or
on the American side, when you show up, they're quick to tell you that there are 400 federal agencies here, and any one of them can review what you've got and inspect you. Most times it was okay. They had a huge x-ray machine, so you take your truck and your trailer, and this huge x-ray would, you get out obviously, and this huge x-ray machine would run over your merchandise, and it would be looking for contraband, drugs or whatever. Occasionally they would make you offload at the dock, and they would tell you, you'd have to pull around to this dock, back in, and then it would have stevedores, hopefully, to help you, and you start unloading. And of course, the trick was, you made it look as difficult as possible. So at a certain point, they got tired of looking at you labor, and say, okay, that's enough. And they would check for markings to make sure that you had you made in Mexico, that you counted your items correctly, that there wasn't contraband, there's no drugs.
Well, I'm assuming you didn't have any of those things.
No.
Just furniture.
But the Sierras was regarded as the breadbasket of drugs, marijuana. There's a lot of growth. There's a lot of exploitation of the tarahumaras in the Sierras in certain regions, remote regions. A lot of the drug gangs from Sinaloa and elsewhere come out there and will take over an area and force the tarahumaras to grow crops.
So you created a safer system for them to work outside of those exploitive situations,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, we gave them an opportunity to do the things that they like, too. They like to make, the women love to make pottery, and guys love to make those wooden bowls, the dough bowls, the bateas. They love to make kiva ladders and work with rawhide, and women love to make the little pine needle baskets and the palm baskets and a variety of other things that we would get, and it allowed them to just do honest work and not be exploited.
And you enjoyed not only helping them do honest work, but doing honest work that pleased yourself.
Yeah, and for an honest pay. There were a lot of traders that exploited these poor people. When you go up to a tarahumara and they have a dish or a pot or a bowl, and it's for sale, and you ask them, well, how much do you want for that? Their response is, what will you give me? And so a lot of traders walk through that door and take advantage, because typically the tarahumara are desperate for money. They're not sophisticated merchants, so that's where they get taken advantage of. And so that's that was my opportunity to treat them right, pay them correctly, pay them an amount that made them satisfied. And so when I would contact them again, they were glad to do business with me. There was one village called Tewarichi, which is further in from Pananashik. And I was the only trader allowed in there. There was a group of nuns that basically ran the village and kept everybody out in order to protect the Tarumaras. But I was allowed to go in. The governors of the village, the Tarumara gentlemen, decided that they liked me and they'd like me to come back. So that was a privilege. And there were a few gentlemen that lived in caves back in Tewarichi that I used to trade with. It was pretty exciting.
So, since we're coming to kind of an end of this, so what would you like to leave for most people that you would come in contact with? If there was something you could share about your experiences, what would you really wish that they would know or they could understand?
I think I would like them to know that it's okay to take the path least traveled or less traveled, as Robert Frost would put it, that in some cases there's exciting life to be lived there. And it's exciting to see life through the eyes of somebody who comes from a totally different experience. And whether you experience that for 6 months or 2 years or umpteen years like I did, experience it. I would seek that out wherever you can. And the fact that I could get in my truck here in Tijeras and drive to this brand new place, otherworldly, totally different, it was fascinating to me. I didn't have to get on an airplane, didn't have to take a boat. It was just a drive away. The distance from here to Austin, basically, from Tijeras to Austin, Texas, in that same amount of time, I was down in the Sierras in another world.
Well, thank you, Dad. I appreciate this. And that will be all.
All right.